Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
What's going to happen to and for our kids? As we continue to find a new normal during the coronavirus pandemic, the question looms pretty large and a tremendous amount of uncertainty remains. For example, the Massachusetts Department of Early Education and Care had to ease restrictions for childcare facilities and summer camps over concerns that the guidelines were financially unrealistic, but now they face concerns that those adjustments could put the health and safety of children and staff at risk. So how do we thread the needle of care and education from infancy all the way through college? And how well has the state done in providing frameworks? We turn to WBUR's Carrie Young and Fred Tice for more. Welcome back, Carrie and Fred.
Hi, Tiziana.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Okay, so I have to admit I've had a little whiplash trying to follow all of this. I just want to start by asking both of you, in covering these issues, do you feel like there's a clear vision and plan for moving forward?
Well, for me, I feel like for early education and care, there is becoming a clear path forward, I guess mostly because they're having to start the soonest. But for the K through 12 sector, that there's still a lot more question marks there for now anyway.
And for
How
higher
about
education,
you, Fred?
Yeah, I would say for higher education, Tiziana, my answer would be no. I would say there are two visions and two plans. Some colleges are moving full steam ahead to reopen campuses and welcome all the back, and others are indicating most classes are going to be online, and then yet others are somewhere in between the two.
And do you think that we're going to continue to kind of have moving targets well into the fall, or are we eventually going to be in some stable place where people regularly know what to expect?
Colleges
Carrie.
Are saying that
Fred,
yeah,
go ahead. Yep.
Yeah.
No, that's fine,
so college,
Fred.
So colleges are saying, you know, by and large, they're going to decide by July 1st. I think we'll have announcements, but the situation continues to change. And I think you could expect colleges to change their minds as the summer moves ahead.
To add to that, I mean, with the K through 12 schools, you know, a lot of the question marks are coming from the fact that they're waiting on official guidance from the state, whether that's either guidelines that are flexible to like regulations that will be inflexible. The state hasn't released that yet. You know, that's coming out any day, but, you know, so they're hoping to have a better idea come July, even August, but a lot of those plans are still up in the air and being finalized. With early education and care, you know, they're taking in plans for reopening right now, actually, and they're making plans 2 months at a time. So we have in the short term or in the short run, some idea of, you know, what that's going to look like, but they leave a little bit more room of, you know, for that to be changing as they go along.
All right, so let's backtrack, Carrie, and I'll stay with you for a minute. Let's talk about childcare, which we talked about right at the top. What are the new restrictions and guidelines for childcare facilities?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the biggest changes have to do with class sizes, at least for centers that provide care, as opposed to caregivers in their home. Anyway, for preschool-aged kids that go to center-based care, for them, each room can have no more than 10 children. The Department of Education and Early Education and Care also wants providers to start doing a health screening each day when kids show up. And then even things like drop-off are going to be looking different. Parents won't be allowed to come in with their kids anymore. There's going to be, you know, a spot outside where they'll have to meet a caregiver and they'll sort of go the rest of the way. And then there's also, you know, things over sharing that's going to be greatly reduced. Water tables, they won't be allowed anymore, at least at first. And staff, if they can't be social distancing or remain a certain distance away from kids, they're going to have to be wearing masks. Those students, that won't be mandatory, the mask wearing, but it will be highly encouraged.
So, Carrie, are parents and facilities concerned that parents aren't going to want to send their kids back to the group childcare situation?
Yeah, there is a lot of concern about that, actually. You know, I mean, how much demand will there be for the supply to reopen? You know, that is a big question mark. You know, and that demand also turns into, you know, like tuition money. And these are small businesses, you know, they're trying to restart their business that's now been closed for several months. And, you know, some parents, we've heard a mixed results there. Like some parents are like, yes, I cannot wait to send my kids back. When is your opening date? And others are a little bit more hesitant for a variety of reasons, and say, you know, I might wait until August or even like when like the typical school year starts to send my child back. And so the state's playing a little bit of a game trying to like anticipate that, but it's still a little hard at this point. You know, and they also want to make sure that providers don't start closing in big numbers if they can't get the numbers that they're expecting back and that expected income coming back as well.
Yeah. So what about that? Is the state making any plans for assistance for facilities that may be wobbling, to use your word?
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on the type of facility that you are and who you serve. So providers that accept state subsidies, so families that send their kids in using a state subsidy, those providers, I've been told, they've been getting payments from the state through the shutdown. So they've been supported a little bit in that way for the last few months now. State officials have also talked about providing some extra funding as time goes on, like in the form of grants or extra funding, just to help these facilities get back on their feet when reopening, you know, even for things like extra costs for PPE and whatnot. But, you know, this is not everyone in this sector. There are a lot of providers who don't accept subsidies and they haven't gotten that support so far and they aren't expected to, at least right now. The Edify desk did talk to the Early Education and Care Commissioner, Sam Eigner-Treewerge, about why the assistance is only being targeted to facilities taking subsidies. We did catch her on a cell phone, keep in mind, but here's how she responded.
This is an issue of with limited dollars making the most strategic decisions possible and knowing that the industry as a whole is impacted, that these dollars are not going to allow us to address the full need.
Yeah, again, what she's saying here is there are limited funds, and the priority right now for them is to make sure that the families that have the greatest need can get this access to this care that they need. But for private providers, you know, they're saying we're struggling financially too, and they would also like some economic support here.
So, Carrie, let's jump ahead to K through 12. Let's look into the fall. What's next school year going to look like? Do we know?
So we don't know, but for sure, really. You know, one thing that I've been hearing, that the patterns that I've been hearing, is that schools are sort of tossing around three types of models. One is that we stay 100% remote like we've been doing. Another one is to try and send everyone back 100%. And then there's somewhere in between the two, like a hybrid model where like they take a cohort of kids and let them be in the school building with teachers for, you know, a week or 2 weeks, and then they rotate. But right now, like where we'll land there's just a lot more questions than answers before we'll be able to, you know, come to an answer on that question. You know, a lot of school leaders are feeling this pressure from communities to release these solid plans, and parents are getting anxious. So are some of the school staff, but, you know, school leaders just really don't know. And I spoke with Bob Tremblay about this. He's the superintendent at Framingham Public Schools. And here's kind of how he describes his situation.
We don't have the answers that we're just keeping to ourselves and not yet ready to share. We simply don't have the answers because we're working literally in the dark here.
And as I mentioned at the beginning, that like one of the biggest unknowns is the guidance and expected regulations from the state. You know, they are working on getting that out. I've been told the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education will be releasing that this month. So that's any day now. We have a little bit of insight as to what those new rules will be. You know, they came out with some personal protective equipment guidelines about a week ago. And so we do know that students and staff will be required to wear masks. And at least at the moment, they're looking at class sizes limited to 10 students and 2 adults.
So time to get Fred in as well. Lots of concerns, Carrie, about how the additional remote learning, other kinds of disparities in access to education opportunities in these hybrid models will affect existing inequities. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
You broke up a little
Carrie,
bit.
Do
there.
I have you?
Yes. Sorry, you broke up there for a second. I think your question was about how the inequities in resources might impact kids if we continue on this remote learning path. And, you know, that is a big concern among educators, you know, whether you are a student who might have a disability. You know, a lot of those teachers have really specialized skills that parents, a lot of parents are really struggling to try to replicate at home. Or there could be things where it's just having the resources, having the computer and the internet access to be able to get the assistance you need with important skills like reading or like developing, you know, your math proficiency. And so, you know, if you are struggling with those types of things, continuing in this asynchronous type of learning, that's going to be hard for a lot of students to make progress.
Okay, so Carrie and Fred, I understand that I'm having some technical difficulties on my end. I'm remote hosting, so if I'm sounding a little choppy, I apologize. Fred, I want to turn to you about the higher ed portion of this. What's the fall going to look like on university campuses?
Well, Tisana, it depends on the university. Some are planning to reopen, like Boston University. It's planning to administer thousands of tests a day to isolate COVID-positive students and singles with their own bathrooms. It'll offer all undergraduate classes online and in person so that students can choose to take classes from home, from their dorm, or in the classroom. But others are headed in a very different direction. Harvard seems to be headed towards offering all but a few classes online as it decides how many undergraduates to allow back to campus. A few who have no place else to go, 30 to 40%, or the entire student body.
So, Fred, how are students handling this kind of uncertainty and the variability depending on where they're going to be?
Well, students want to come back to campus, but not everybody thinks that's a very good idea. I talked to Harvard graduate student Max Ehrenfreund. He taught undergraduates this spring, and he remembers what happened in March when Harvard shut the campus down and told students to pack up and go home.
They just threw a party. They started around 3 p.m. that day. I think it was a Tuesday. And they just kept going all night. And that's exactly how I expect Harvard students would react if they were invited back to campus in the fall.
Ehrenfreund says the students would be really excited to see their friends, to be back with the people they know and love. And he just did not see them being too careful about the virus under those circumstances.
Okay, Fred, before I let you and Carrie go, one last question for you. I saw some news regarding Harvard and standardized testing. I know that's come up for some other universities as well. Can you catch us up to speed on that one briefly?
Absolutely. So like BU, Harvard is planning to offer thousands of tests a day if it does bring students back to campus in large numbers. It's also planning to offer help to other colleges. Already, the Broad Institute, run by Harvard and MIT, has provided testing for the community at large. And with regard to colleges at large, a committee led by Wellesley College President Paula Johnson is working on recommendations. I heard from one college president that the expectation is that colleges will test all their students twice a week, but BU President Bob Brown has said he expects the frequency of testing to vary depending on whether a student lives alone or shares a bathroom with lots of other students.
All right. So that's a lot there. Fred and Carrie, what's the most important thing you're each going to watch for going forward? Carrie, you first.
Okay, you go.
Well, I mean, for me, what I am watching for in K through 12 schools is funding and budgets. There was the new Student Opportunity Act that was supposed to send a lot of, much needed funding to schools that may not be coming through. So we're anticipating some cuts. We'll watch to see what they are.
And how about you, Fred?
I'm waiting to see which colleges survive. Already we've seen that Boston College is absorbing Pine Manor College. Other colleges are struggling. They need to have students return to campus. But at some colleges, attendance is going to be down this fall. And it's not clear how long they can survive by being exclusively online.
All right. That's WBUR's Fred Tice and Carrie Young. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tisana.
As our country continues to reckon with race, non-Black communities of color have sought to show solidarity with Black America. That includes the Asian American and Pacific Islander community. Not surprisingly, these can be complicated conversations about race. Here in Massachusetts, a recent statement released by the Commonwealth's Asian American Commission noted that, quote, Asian Americans continue to benefit from the model minority myth and our historic proximity to white privilege, end quote. and that the death of George Floyd, quote, pushes us to confront how AAPI people can be complicit in anti-Black racism and oppression, end quote. Those words have sparked a debate over racism and privilege among local Asian American and Pacific Islanders, and questions about how the community can move forward productively to address systemic racism. We have two guests joining us today to talk about all of this. The first is Vera Duongmanee Cage, chairperson for Massachusetts' Asian American Commission. Welcome, Vera.
Hi, good afternoon.
Do we have you?
Hi, yes. Vera.
And also with glad us is here. Linda Champion. Glad to have you. Linda Champion, attorney and assistant general counsel to the state's Department of Industrial Accidents. Linda, welcome to you too.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
So Vera, I do want to start with the commission and the statement. What was the commission's goal with the statement?
We thought it would be important to issue a bold and strong statement of solidarity with Black Lives Matter, to acknowledge our position in white supremacy or whiteness in this country. You know, this country, we talk a lot about Black and white, and we wanted to speak up at this point.
Some members of the commission and of the Asian American community, Vera, have expressed concern about statements regarding anti-blackness, proximity to white privilege. What do you say to those concerns?
Oh, the concerns are there. They're what people are feeling. So I certainly don't want to ignore that or say that those sentiments do not exist.
And Vera, as the conversation continues, Linda, I'm going to turn to you in just a moment. Vera, as the conversation continues, what is your goal to have be front and center in the discussion?
Right now, the Black community is reeling, mourning. It's a state of I think, shock. And for us, we're just trying to figure out how we can mobilize together, how we can support one another, how we can address racial tensions that have existed, you know, within our communities. Also to reflect on the examples of solidarity and working together and coalition building. How do we strengthen that? How do we do more of it? How do we be more effective in ending racism and recognizing that the institutions that we exist in, the system, how we're socialized from our educational system, looking at how our criminal justice system is meted out and practiced in this country, how all of those things, how that impacts, you know, the Asian American community, how that impacts Black communities. We all need to talk about Black lives, and we need to talk about why Black lives matters, right, within our communities, and to address the anti-Blackness that is real as well in our communities. So there's so many resources out there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you, and I don't mean to be disrespectful. It's just I'm anxious to also bring Linda's voice into the conversation here. So I'm going to take a pause there because I want to turn to Linda and just ask a couple of questions about the pieces we've already covered. Linda, as someone who identifies as both Asian and Black, you had some concerns with the statement that came out from the commission. Can you talk with us a little bit about that?
So my position on the statement that came out from the commission is I felt that it just wasn't reflective of me as a person, and certainly didn't reflect the values of my family. My mother's a Korean American. She came to this country while the Vietnam War was sort of winding down. My parents met when my father served in Vietnam. And I think that for someone to make a broad stroke and suggest that Asians are anti-Black, it that struck a chord with me, and it didn't strike a chord with me in a positive way. I think that for my mother, there should be no doubt that she fell in love with a Black man. She had three beautiful Black children, and she raised those children in the South, in Texas, and in a segregated community for the most part. And the suggestion that all Asians, or the suggestion that, you know, a statement with so much complexity as interracial tensions that exist, not only in Asian American communities, but also within the Black community, those interracial tensions cannot be reduced to a byline, and it certainly can't be reduced to a paragraph in a press release. Those issues, Linda, are complex and complicated.
Linda, when I asked Vera just now, you know, what do you want to keep front and center in the conversation, she gave a very clear and robust list of issues that she wants to stay focused on. What's your response to that? Are those the issues you want front and center in this conversation?
So the thing I want front and center in the conversation is that right now, Black lives matter. And the reason Black lives matter is because Black lives are those lives that are in danger. And as a community, both the Asian community and as communities of color, all communities of color, we need to, yes, have honest conversations about racism. But now is the time for us to come together with an issue that is at the forefront of all of our lives, because we watched and witnessed a man lose his life in front of our own eyes. Black lives matter. It doesn't mean other lives doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that racism doesn't exist. It doesn't mean that we're not going to be dealing with and grappling with the issues of racism. But it also means for me that I don't want to see racial tensions that exist. We saw those racial tensions play out in Los Angeles in the aftermath of the Rodney King trial. We saw a trucker driving his load through a city street and being dragged out of his car and beaten. Did he personally do anything to anyone? No, but he was a white man driving a truck. And I do not want to see that type of backlash come to my mother, to my family, who doesn't share in that anti-Blackness rhetoric or sentiment.
So, Linda, I'd like to give Vera a chance to just kind of respond to some of the things that she just heard. Vera, let me invite you to respond.
Yeah. You know, the press statement was developed by a few members of the commission, and it was the second iteration, what you see. And I think it's a really important document to really study and to look at. We bring up Yuri Kochiyama. We bring up Grace Lee Boggs. We bring up examples in history where there's been solidarity. And, you know, contemporarily, we could have, you know, talked about many different Asian American leaders who are doing really good work effectively within and with Black communities. So I want to point that out as well. And I do know that, and I want to acknowledge Linda's experience. I think she has an exceptional position to be in both worlds and to experience both worlds. And I had the opportunity to just, you know, try to get to know Linda a little bit more. And I do know that there was a meeting where, Linda, you spoke with Korean-American, Korean business owners, and you talked about the Black Korean experience. And I think that that's important to raise, you know, how do we treat our own, right? How does colorism play into the dynamics of our families, the dynamics of acceptance, of being, you know, accepted or disowned, or how do we bring families together? Because I've been in that experience, and I think it's important to know that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And that's what I'm excited to be at the helm of the Asian American Commission, to bring Linda's experience into the forefront, to bring in so many different perspectives, including people who reject that there is, you know, a benefit to white being in white proximity, right? So let's bring everybody together, and let's have these difficult conversations. Because, you know, the rest of the world, you know, is burning, and we're also hurting and impacted when our family members, Linda, are getting murdered by the hands of the police.
Linda.
Yes.
So I both want to invite you to respond to anything you might have heard from Vera there. And then I want to ask both of you, There is a complicated history there. When we talk about race, there's always complicated history. And this is a moment where our focus on race in the country is specifically on anti-Blackness. How do you both envision a dialogue going forward in the Asian American Pacific Islander community that emphasizes solidarity and support of our Black community while we're talking about anti-Blackness, and also wrestles with any internal pain that may need to come forward in these discussions? I know that's a complicated question.
So for me, it's not complicated. I think that we as individuals each need to look in the mirror and look at the racism which exists within ourselves and in our hearts. And like my mom explained to me back in the 60s, before she had ever seen a Black person in Korea, she said that the images of Blackness and the images of Black people were played out on television, and all of those images were always barbaric, and all of those images were always negative. And the first time she met my father, she felt afraid, but she didn't know what she was afraid of. But all she could remember were those images and the stereotypes that she had seen on TV of African tribes and how they captured animals and how they skinned animals and all these other images that were all negative against Black people. And so, but my mom, despite all of those images, took the time to get to know someone as a human being and then made a decision about a person as a human being. So until we get real with the racism that exists within us, we cannot move forward. And it's great that we're having this conversation about race, but I can tell you that just because one group experiences racism in one way and a different group experiences in a different way, it's still painful, it's still hurtful, and it cannot be ignored. So to get to the next step, we can't continue to talk about, well, who was discriminated more than the other, and what generation or what race experienced it worse than the other. The reality is that right now in this moment, we have an opportunity to make a change in the lives of so many people by communities of color coming together and working together. And we have a unique opportunity to say that we don't condone it. The problem is not Blackness. The problem is not me, my color as a Black woman. The problem is the power and the policies that are used against me that hurt my ability to be successful, that hurt my ability to live, that have essentially taken a contract that the government gives us as people of color, and they've essentially broken it. They've said this applies to everyone, but it doesn't apply to you. And the people right now who feel the brunt of that, and we've seen it played out, are men of color. And as a community of color, where do we go from here? We all have to unite. It's not pointing the finger and saying this person suffered more. We've all suffered from racism.
So Linda, I want to build on that. We've got just a minute or so left, and I want to turn back to Vera and say, so Vera, as the head of the commission, how do you want to move forward in next steps and in dialogue and in bringing the commission back together?
I want to invite everyone who is interested in helping us chart a path forward to get in touch with the Asian American Commission, because we need to take advantage of this opportunity to bring people together, to solve problems, to heal, to talk, and to chart a course forward that brings our voices, our experiences together. I don't know, you know, I don't have a blueprint. I need other people to help us. So I encourage community members, community leaders to please reach out, as we will be reaching out right now and in the short future. And I also want to reach out to Linda to have her be included in the work that we want to do that is inclusive and that is doesn't trigger people to distance themselves or walk away. We want all people to engage and be able to make the change that we want to see in this world.
Well, I appreciate you both beginning to engage with us today and with our listeners on this conversation. That's Vera Duong-Mani Cage, chairperson for Massachusetts Asian American Commission. Vera, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you.
And Linda Champion, attorney and assistant general counsel to the state's Department of Industrial Accidents. Linda, thanks.
Thank you for having us.
As we heard earlier, schools and childcare facilities are still figuring out reopening, and our physical environment has changed rapidly since Memorial Day. Eateries are opening with outdoor seating, retail stores are open, playgrounds, splash pools. And at the same time, we're in the fourth week of protests and demonstrations against police violence and racism here in Boston and around the country. So we thought you might have questions about coronavirus, reopening, safety, testing. What do you need to know? Call with your questions at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have two doctors with us today to help answer those questions and have this conversation. The first is Dr. Rochelle Walensky. She's a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, a practicing infectious disease physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and Brigham and Women's Hospital. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Dr. Walensky.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
And with us is Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center. She's also Treasurer of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Thanks for being with us again, Dr. Boucher.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana. Nice to be with you.
So it's been a little while since we've talked to the two of you, and I hadn't originally planned to ask you this question first, but I'm gonna because I'm the host and I get to ask what I want to first. What has changed most for you in your understanding of the virus or in what you're focusing on in, let's say, the last 3 weeks? Dr. Boucher.
Well, that's a really good question. And I think that probably the most prominent focus has been on the mitigation measures that seem to be the most impactful in helping to prevent the spread of the virus. So that includes focusing on when we're going to be social, doing it outside, still maintaining the physical distance and using masks. I think the data on masks continues to emerge that they work. Covering our face works. And so we had some new data yesterday talking about the difference between exposures inside and outside. And it shows again that being outside lowers the risk of any exposure that you could have. So as we're in this reopening phase, those are two areas I think that require more focus and are hopeful in some ways.
And Dr. Walensky, how about you?
Great. You know, I'm going to take the other side of that coin. Since Dr. Boucher spoke about mitigation and the environment, maybe I'll talk about what we're learning in some of the science. But not that that's not science, but in terms of how we treat the virus, there's been some exciting news about vaccines and some launching of some vaccine trials that are probably going to happen in the middle of the summer. We've learned something about remdesivir, hydroxychloroquine, and now dexamethasone as recent as today. And then, some prevention interventions, the hydroxychloroquine prevention studies that came out. So I think we're learning a lot in the science of how we might vaccinate and how we might treat.
All right, before we go to calls, and they are starting to come in fast, because you brought up remdesivir, dexamethasone, hydroxychloroquine, can you just quickly, either or both of you, give us a rundown on where we stand in sort of effective and promising or not on all three of those? And those, let me clarify, as I understand it, all three are about treatment, not prevention.
It's true. Maybe I'll start with one and pass it to Dr. Boucher. So hydroxychloroquine, we learned last week that the NIH panel has recommended against the use of hydroxychloroquine for the treatment of coronavirus. There have been now lots of large observational studies that have not shown efficacy. We still wait a large-scale clinical trial, although smaller clinical trials have also not shown efficacy, and it has shown some harm in terms of abnormal heart rhythms. We also had one smaller clinical trial for hydroxychloroquine that demonstrated it didn't work for prevention. So maybe then I'll pass one of the other two to Dr. Boucher.
Great.
Dr. Boucher.
Sure. I'll mention the dexamethasone. So data just emerged today from a study done in the United Kingdom by a group from Oxford that showed that using dexamethasone for 10 days in patients who were sick with COVID compared to using standard therapy resulted in a mortality survival benefit. And the protection was greatest in the sickest patients. So patients on ventilators received the most benefit from this really simple and inexpensive drug, to the point where one death could be prevented by treating 8 COVID-infected patients on ventilators with this medicine. So that is, I would say, a potential game changer. and something that can be implemented and is probably the first trial to show a mortality benefit in this disease. So it's big news, I would say.
And will remdesivir, I know remdesivir has been in trials here in the Commonwealth. Are these dexamethasone, remdesivir, are these drugs that are available in the healthcare network here in the Commonwealth, things that will, as they're better proven and or embraced, if they are, that they'll be available to people here?
I would say the good news is that dexamethasone is readily available and it's inexpensive. I still think we need to see the data from these from the study that Dr. Boucher is citing, that those are fresh data from today that were released in press release, but we haven't seen the paper yet. We haven't seen any of the data yet. Remdesivir is a little harder to access. It's emergency use authorization. It's not yet FDA approved, and it's only made by one company with limited supply. It's been distributed through Massachusetts through the country. But we're pretty cautious about who we're giving it to right now. And we're giving it early in disease. Dexamethasone, as Dr. Boucher suggested, we're giving later in disease. So I think they each have their own place in the disease process. But remdesivir, we have less access to for sure than we do dexamethasone.
All right, let's start turning to some calls. What are your calls for Drs. Walensky and Boucher today? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's start with Debbie in Randolph. Debbie, go ahead.
Hello. I have been seeing my grandchildren at a distance in the driveway and backyards. I was wondering when we could spend more time together, maybe even give them a hug.
Oh, Debbie, you're breaking my heart. Please, Drs. Walensky and Boucher.
You want to take that?
Yeah, this is really hard, Debbie, and I'm sorry. You know, the evidence that we have is that grandparents and older people, as well as people who have underlying health conditions, things like diabetes, heart disease, are at the greatest risk for doing poorly with COVID. We also have data that children and really young adults tend to be the ones who get infected and can spread the disease. So we're still recommending keeping some distance from the grandkids. And so I think that the driveway visiting and doing creative things on FaceTime are the best and the most safe ways until we get a little further down the road to keep you the safest. Dr. Walensky, what do you think?
I completely agree. And the only thing I would add to that is to understand what your family's risk is. So if everybody's kind of been home quarantining for 2 weeks, it's probably the case that they're have low risk, right? However, if the parents have been out, if the kids have been in daycare, if the kids have been mixing with other kids, then I completely agree with what Dr. Boucher is saying, and probably safest to be outside and enjoy them from afar.
Let's grab another call here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Lisa on the line from Wellesley. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi, we are planning an annual family vacation where we have family members coming together from different parts of the country. And, we've been kind of monitoring the different phases of the reopening, and we're trying to come up with a way to bring people in. Some are flying by plane from California, some are driving from states in the South. And we're just kind of wondering, is it okay to share a house together or should we not? And, should we try to get tested before we come together? And would that give us any kind of assurance that maybe we wouldn't be putting each other at risk? Or what would you recommend for that type of a family trip or our attempts to have that kind of a family trip?
I imagine that's a question for a lot of people this summer. Please go ahead.
I totally endorse family vacations, and I think all of us are feeling the same tension. And this very much goes back to some of the comments I made from the previous caller, and that is, how have all of the families who are coming together been behaving? Has everybody been equally careful? Has everybody really generally been staying home, really been trying to socially distance, wearing their masks, asymptomatic? Are people generally healthy? So if one were to get infected, are they at lower risk? Are they generally generally younger? And then really, how can you be safest while you're traveling? If you're traveling through airports, trying to sort of maintain some distance on the plane, certainly wearing masks on the plane, but also in the airport itself, trying to stay away from touch surfaces, trying to stay away from crowds. The airports are probably more of a challenge than the airplanes themselves because the airplanes have great air circulation. Similar to the folks who are driving, trying to stay away from you know, rest stops and things where you might have touch surfaces would probably be your safest bet.
And Dr. Boucher, what about after Lisa's vacation? And part of the reason I'm asking is I know we have at least one other caller who's got a similar question about, you know, siblings all coming together under one roof. So Dr. Walensky's given us some sense for how do you think about going into that kind of vacation. What about afterward?
Well, another great question. And I think after any potential exposure, and really almost any exposure as we open up socially, the greatest risk is in the about first 5 days, but the risk goes out to 14 days. And so really monitoring for symptoms and getting tested if you develop any symptoms, even mild symptoms, and then making sure to stay away from anyone who's at risk. So back to what Dr. Walensky was saying, if you return home to your own home, you know, keep your distance from older relatives and friends and others who might be at risk due to underlying medical conditions.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Holly on the line from Newton. Holly, what's your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding pregnancy and trying to get pregnant during the time of COVID. My partner and I started trying at a clinic just before in February and in March, and we just got the go-ahead to start trying again. But from a doctor's perspective of being pregnant and potentially going back to work in the fall, where I work with a lot of young children, just curious about if there's been anything new about risks to pregnancy.
Great question.
There are not a ton of data in pregnancy that demonstrate that outcomes for pregnant women are worse than any other. And so I think, you know, I think medical systems are generally safe places to be. So in terms of accessing the clinic, that's actually quite a safe place. It should be a safe place. We're encouraging people to come back to medical care, but in general. And then I would say there are not a lot of data to suggest that your pregnancy would be at higher risk. We are suggesting that pregnant women perhaps stop working in medical systems at 37 weeks just in case. But for the most part, there are not a lot of data to suggest that now is not a good time to get pregnant.
So Drs. Boucher and Walensky, before I go back to additional calls, there are a couple other things I want to make sure we also ask around some current events. We know that we are several weeks now into large public protests. We're also several weeks into reopening. Both are going to bring people into greater proximity with each other. Have you seen anything in the hospitals to indicate whether we're at risk of increased spread from either type of increased contact with each other? I think our numbers are staying low. Is that what you're seeing in the hospitals as well?
We're seeing, you know, continued decline in the numbers of both infected individuals being hospitalized and dying from COVID, which is really good news. It is important to point out that it's usually 2 to 3 weeks after exposures of the type we're discussing where we would see things like hospitalizations. So it's a little bit early. And I'll also mention that Governor Baker has, in recognition of these potential exposures, made arrangements for testing at 52 sites across Massachusetts tomorrow and Thursday that will be available confidentially and at no cost to people who were at these large events. So that it is really encouraging people to be tested so that we can recognize any infection early and stop the spread before it, you know, occurs and becomes a bigger problem. So really want to encourage folks who feel like they might have been exposed to take advantage of that opportunity.
We had a physician on maybe a week and a half ago who expressed some concern that if we do see a spike in cases, because these two trends were coincidental, the phase two of reopening and the emergence of large-scale protests here in the Commonwealth, that people who were protesting might get scapegoated for spread that wasn't a result of those protests. And from a contact tracing standpoint, et cetera, do we have enough information now that if we do see spikes, we'll know where they come from so that we can adjust accordingly?
I think that's going to be tough. Contact tracing is a laborious task, and it's going to be hard, especially when people might have been both in the protests as well as in other places related to the reopening. What I will say is, especially looking at footage from other places around the country and being involved in some of the conversations about how Massachusetts has been handling these protests, first, I want to convey how horrific it is that we are in a coincidence of these two pandemics related to both COVID-19 and racism. I think it's really important that these protest voices are heard. And for the most part, it has been done in such a way that is intended to keep people safe, that people are remaining safe, that people are wearing masks, and that there's access to testing. So I think in the context of the fact that these are critical voices to hear, that it's being done in as safe a way.
Okay, and in our last couple of minutes, I won't have time to go back to more calls, but I will summarize at least one or two of the questions. One theme in the questions is eating together, whether you're at a sidewalk cafe or maybe you're now thinking of having family over for a meal. Obviously, you are not wearing a mask while you're eating. So how does one think about safety as we begin to eat in congregate again?
You know, this is really important, Tiziana, and I think that you know, the basics of trying to set the places as far apart as we can, eat outside if we can, not share dishes, utensils, glasses, and really, to the extent possible, have things served individually. That will limit the potential risk, not make it zero, but will make it lower. I think those are some good initial first steps. Dr. Walensky, other thoughts?
The only thing I would add is to make sure everyone is symptom-free.
Okay, and so just last question we do, briefly, 30 seconds or so. What is the status of antibody testing? Are we getting more reliable there?
My short answer is we still have a lot to learn. There are still rates of false positives, still rates of false negatives. We also don't know exactly what they mean, but our learning curve is steep and we're learning more every day.
Agree.
All right. Well, no, please go ahead and finish that thought.
Yeah, no, I agree fully. We are very, you know, we're gratified that the science is advancing. We needed to come a little further before it's ready for sort of prime time to be used in individual cases. Antibody testing is very helpful in understanding what's happening in a population or a community. So we're grateful to have it. We need the science to advance a little bit more for us.
Well, this has been so helpful. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, Dr. Helen Boucher, I really appreciate you joining us to answer callers' questions today. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.